This is a reading from Richard Rose's Alvagen Papers, the third paper, titled Veil of Maya. And this is a subsection titled On Theology. Let us survey this massive subject that has furnished mankind with personal, perennial hope and eternal strife, mentally and physically, individually and nationally. It would be of scientific value to chart the early origins of religion and the evolution of those origins in order to observe the sequence of changes, as well as the religiously revolutionary figures who expedited those changes. There are works that deal with the evolution of religion that can be studied by the reader. They include the heavy works of Blavatsky and Max Müller and The Golden Bough by Frazier. Frazier has done quite a bit of research on the growth of a complex god from primitive gods of the fields, of the hunt, or of war. Thus, we have the possibility that the early corn god may be the father of current religious thinking, or the possibility that there was a divine emanation waiting for a primitive man to divest himself of the corn god, which emanation appeared on earth in widely separated places at about the same time. The time embraced the period from 563 BC to 570 AD. Zoroaster was born in the 6th century BC. Buddha lived from 563 to 483 BC. Then Christ came in the year 1. And we have Muhammad in the year 570 AD. And so, bypassing historical research, I would like to go directly to the major categories of religion in order to make a comparative study of the different definitions and concepts. We have the monastic viewpoint, which means that God permeates everything, including the human soul and body. Next, the dualistic God, or God as a separate being. The regional God, such as Jehovah, who was considered to be only the God of the Jews, and by some to be a planetary spirit. The phallic God, a sort of humanized masculine evolution, symbolized from the Hebraic letter Jod. God, the undefinable, represented by the letters J-H-V-H. The God within, the inner self. God as being the automatic law of the universe, but lacking in personality. Any of the thousands of gods worshipped by sects or tribes. Concerning the concepts of multiple gods, they are difficult to categorize because some of the one-god doctrines confuse the layman with complex sub-theories, such as the doctrine of the Trinity. There is an argument also that there is a hierarchy of gods, and some translators of the Bible point out that such is meant by the word Elohim, which is an intentional plural word. The Buddhists also mention a god hierarchy which they call the Dhyan Chohens, or Bodhisattvas, which are sometimes given an exact number. This brings us to the Asian concept of gods, which have evolved from humans, as in the case of Gautama Buddha. For future reference, I wish to list certain concepts on life after death. Number 1. Reincarnation, either upward toward Godhead or toward dissolution. Number 2. Reoccurrence, a theory more complex but no more provable than the others. This has to do with the reoccurrence of a human being, either by design or by accident, identical to a previous human being of another era. The argument is that such beings, if alike in all ways, are the same being. Another version of this theory is that the individual man is actually a life strand in a timeless continuum, with the only motion being the progression of that man's consciousness along that life strand. Reoccurrence for him would be a repeat performance of such life strand travel. In simple words, it means reliving this same life over and over. Some spiritualists claim that this pastime is available to all after death, but that after a while the game grows boring and is abandoned. Number 3, reincarnation, White's concept. This theory supposedly evolved as a result of considerable work in automatic writing with a spirit guide doing the dictation. In this theory, the human is born unique, having never lived before as the same being. That which is born of the spirit is spirit, and that which is born of the flesh is used to identify the concept. One or more spiritual parents manufacture a spirit and then look about for a woman about to become pregnant or about to deliver. The child spirit thus finds itself a child body. Number 4. Spiritualism. Spiritual evolution after death through possibly a half a dozen planes. Number 5. Christianity's paradise or hell. This belief differs from the foregoing concept in that it allows neither for another life in this plane nor any further refinement or growth after death. One life, one eternity. Number 6. Immortality through faith. It is held by some that there is a dimensional matrix that is subject to the faith of men. Levi, in one of his books of magic, gives the formula for creation. Number 7. Immortality through mechanical means, concentrating upon a chakra, observation of certain sounds, prayers, etc. Number 8. Translation. This theory claims that some people may develop an immortal body by means of a slow change. Number 9. Union with the Absolute. Satori. Number 10. Oblivion. Can we pick up where Max Müller leaves off and discuss the inevitable? Still, the hunger in man demands an answer, and man is annoyed by the inconsistencies of the mighty. It is possibly true that all is rationalization, even this. But if we are to blush at hope, then we must pursue some sort of mathematics and even risk the answer of zero. All of this in retrospect, in respect for the straw or any other tiny foothold of a word or sentence that might be an anchor. If all else fails, it shall be an effort. An effort shall beget effort. On the other side, silence and inactivity will only beget silence and stagnation. Let us look for the reasoning in some of the age-old beliefs and begin with monism. If God is everywhere, then he is complete, in complete charge, and the quest for truth is foolish, as well as the pursuit of any action. We would be only an infinitesimal expression of this being. Add omnipotence to the omnipresence, and every aspiration becomes vanity for what seem to be separate mortals. Yet the religions that preach such monism still preach free will also in order to hold their flocks accountable. Then we hear the old expression that God is powerful enough to stop us, but that he allows us to do evil. This can only read that he allows himself to do evil. Then what could a singular God entity do that would be qualified as being less than deific conduct when, by his absoluteness, by definition, he cannot be adjudged one way or another? It is hard to determine if our Christian God is one of monism or dualism. The Catholic dogmas and catechisms express beyond a doubt that he is everything. Yet those same catechisms make much of human guilt. Would they blame man for the creation of the human being? Predestination would indicate a monistic concept and an all-powerful God, but the advocates of predestination also preach morality. It has been said that man makes God in his own image and likeness. Could it be that man, being a bifocal, bicameral, polarized creature, feels it necessary to see everything in a relative manner? Regardless, if everything is God, this writing would appear to be as foolish as any other action, but the efforts to know such truth, if it be the truth, or to find our true state of being should not be arrested. We should not qualify the results of an adventure until the project is completed. The Summa Theologica pretends to prove the existence of a monistic God by using a dualistic mechanism. It observes that the universe is in motion and ergo must have a mover. The mover must be God. This separates God from the universe and makes him a sort of chief engineer over the visible dimensional universe. Being a mover of physical objects removes from God the need to participate in functions of non-visible planes or dimensions, so that such theology is more of a cosmology. Thomas Aquinas lived before Einstein and Ouspensky and consequently did not have to argue with them about the nature of motion, which must of necessity be relative to time in a timeless continuum. The greatest bit of frustration in Catholic teaching is to be told on one hand that the Summa Theologica is the highest theology and to be told by the same theologian that the finite mind cannot ever perceive the infinite. In regard to dualism, we find that dualism at least gives us the privilege of being a searcher with an objective. We must all go along on this tack, at least until we find out that we do not exist as an individual. Yet as we go and create concepts, counter-concepts are automatically born, and for every virtue that we find, counter-virtue is created, and thus is born the devil. Sometimes the devil is not the only competitor of God. There is a belief involving celestial politics in which the sundry gods hide behind the curtain of dimension and try to entice the souls of men away from other gods. An erudite theosophist recently stated that he held this to be the esoteric truth behind all religions. In works of magic, we find invocations to some of these ancient gods, and practitioners as recent as Eliphas Levi believe that those gods are still real and still retain the life which centuries of faith bestowed upon them. It is interesting to note here also the efforts of churches in modern times to promote a drive for souls and the exhortations of churches to parishioners to increase and multiply. Why do the gods need men? Unless this is divine dualism, strained to the utmost, why should these celestial beings have terrestrial roots dependent somehow upon nourishment from fleshlings? There is still another disturbing note that is echoed by scholar and clod alike. Why do the gods remain hidden? If there is a personal God more powerful than man, why does he seemingly impose a set of rules or conditions upon man and himself? This rule holds that the fleshling must guess the correct name, which he must cry out at night, protesting his desire to be food for celestial roots or to be a constituent. The use of logic implies a mechanistic attack upon a problem that has its answer in the abstract magnitude. Knowing this difficulty, many seekers use the methods of the mystics, which involve intuitional meditation or some form of concentration. It would be impossible for a man to choose a path from logic alone. Reason will sway the mind toward a movement, but intuition plays the larger role in the choosing of spiritual paths. The theory of reincarnation is an example in that it seems to be more reasonable than one life, one death theory. But reincarnation has not been proven either, even though there are many testimonials of the remembering of previous lives. So that if reincarnation is accepted, the acceptance comes from largely from intuition. It is argued that it is more just system than the concept of eternal punishment or reward for helpless reactions to the circumstances of life. It has an understandable structural conception of the relation of action to consequences when it associates the theory of reincarnation with the idea of automatic karma. However, we cannot accept a theory only because it has a conceptual structure that is pretty or appeals to human standards of justice. On the testimonial side, there have been people who have demonstrated, honestly or otherwise, that they could recall previous incarnations. Some cases have been carefully witnessed, especially cases where a young person describes the place of his previous life or people now living who live contemporarily with his previous life. There are rituals in Tibet by which the monks determine the identity of a child in a previous life. The Tibetans choose their Dalai Lama by this process. Hypnosis cannot be considered as a valid means for determining previous incarnations, although it has been used here in the West to attempt that task. Hypnotic subjects have been found to be able to assume many characteristics upon command by the operator, and have given evidence about any personality named at random as being their previous incarnation. I have verified this through hypnotic experimentation and several other hypnotists with whom I know have witnessed the same results. The subject simply adopts the personality suggested and at times, amazingly enough, will come up with facts about that personality that neither the subject nor the operator knew. The Rosicrucians have a method of seeing your past incarnations, but gazing for long periods of time into mirrors is not very evidential in method, and the results must be qualified by the knowledge that the human eye under prolonged strain is not very reliable. We come now to mechanical means for reaching salvation or for attaining wisdom. One such is baptism, a sacrament which involves water and a degree of surrender to divine will. Some who believe baptism to be necessary also believe that without it, the soul goes to hell or to a lake of fire. The Catholic Church teaches that the unbaptized go to limbo. Baptism, of course, has fundamentalistic origins, but there has not been a valid explanation for the use of earthly water to change a supposed spiritual condition. I can understand the change of being that may be brought about by the surrender of egotistical aspects of the personality, but I cannot rationalize the use of water as a celestial catalyst. Not only is the Christian religion beset with fundamentalism, but every religion that has inspired writings has the same trouble. And it is not enough that we suffer our abstractions to be handed down to us in the form of parable and translated histories, but we are subjected to further confusion by still more tangential philosophies which claim for truth by the application of symbolism to the Bible, or the application of numerology to the original alphabet of the Bible. and this with the knowledge that the original documents are unobtainable. Can the truth actually be this complicated? Can wisdom rattled loose from the convolutions by the bombardment of the mind with myriad symbols? Yet this is a school of thought. It has been said that all wisdom that is verbalizable is but the results of the juggling of symbols. With the beginning of symbolism studies, the intuition recedes from fundamentalism. Emotional games are not enough to keep the people in the churches, even though the churches have become social centers, utilitarian crime preventers, or conduct inhibitors of questionable value. The mass mind of man as a computer manifests its decisions more by its apathy than by its interest. Worship consists of a smooth confluence of egos. That man can be inspired by reading the Bible cannot be denied, nor could it be denied that he might be inspired by studying Raphael's Ephemeris. If juggling will do the trick, then why not the Tarot or the I Ching? I wish to avoid any great amount of criticism of the fundamentalistic approach. Fundamentalistic interpretations bog down in the ambiguity and obscurity of both literal and interlinear import, and we could spend endless hours arguing about the intended meanings. And it is not valid to take the Bible to be one of those divine voices merely because the book always says so, any more than we should fall down and worship a totem pole because the inscription on the pole reads, "I am God, worship me." There must be valid indications or substantiations indicative of the Bible's authority, such as witnesses from outside the Bible, preferably from an all-able God. There is an argument that uncertain ritualistic steps are necessary for beings of lesser development whose nature and karma will not allow them to accept the philosophic side or essence of religion, so that such people are doomed to spend this life by frittering away their time by singing chorals or quoting the scriptures. And this is both the truth and cleverness. There are people who are unable to seek for truth with dynamic energy and average faculties, but I have reservations about using religion as an anodyne or exchanging lies for tithes. The time has come when another layer of superstition and fearful umbrage should be lifted. Believe what you will, but do not legislate. Belief is no proof for belief. Belief may even create, but then different beliefs will still produce monstrosities and confusion. God remains forever hidden from mankind and to believe our elders. He is only able to communicate through material objects or through some high priest who thinks no more of his altar than to take his meals from it and glorify his animal exigencies with it. Drinking of alcohol has been justified by using the biblical reference of Christ drinking wine. Quotations can be found to justify various carnal expressions. You can split yourself like a schizophrenic and let the breast boast that it is no part of that which supports it, placing virtue in the heart and head and giving the devil to the hindmost. It is not possible to understand or follow a system of thinking that begets subsciences and rubrics ad infinitum. This paper is directed to lives of less than 100 years that hope for light within that span of time. Nor can we study every religion. Such a search would be the equivalent of the task of the demons at a Chinese funeral who must pick up every piece of showered confetti in order to find the soul of the deceased. We are looking for the most consistent, and we must be justified in abandoning too much inconsistency. For instance, in the Summa Theologica, we find that evil is supposed to emanate from good. Yet the wee bipolar bicameral bipeds are supposed to be headed for purgatory, limbo, or hell for not avoiding evil. This reasoning is the result of a split purpose by the author, who would appear erudite while trying to inspire fear. We are led to believe, by seeing repeated conflicting sub-theories in great religious writings, that some of the authors were interested in constructing speculative philosophies for the edification of their egos. Cosmologies abound. Some harmonize a little better than others on a point or two, or they combine a complex, exotic idea with that which we wish to believe. And the more complicated the diagrammed treatise, the more it flatters such minds with pride, would not let them settle for a simple theory. Nearly 2,000 years of Christianity have not given us one two-edged sword alone. The blades are like the leaves of grass. Each man's religion is a stranger to his neighbors. We cannot expect that will be any different in the next 500 years. But each who sees this chaos or babble should want to simplify things a bit. Man should likewise have reverence for honest effort, whether it be in the field of fundamentalism, astrology, magic, or any other. While threading our way among the many paths, let us do so with respect, and yet have the courage to criticize. And let the criticism be as honest and as sacred to us as that which we criticize is sacred to those who hold a different point of view. And if there is a feeling of resentment, it can only be for those who treat truth lightly or who laugh at the hungry while feeding from their sweat. Let us have a brief look at hell. Celestial schizophrenia and spiritual masochism. Hell must be the womb of the Almighty, from which came evil or the devil. Evil must have a headquarters. If we go back to the ancients, we find that those pagans were more civilized. Except for the Tibetans, they did not believe that the soul was tortured after death. The pagan feared the shaman's magic, not his cosmology. We do not hear of an unhappy hunting ground in Indian lore. Valhalla was not a dreaded place. Hades had no terrifying negative qualities. Gehenna was the city dump. Sheol was the grave, not a fiery pit. The early Christian church must have borrowed from Tibetan paganism. Dante's sadomasochistic writings may well have been an attempt at legal pornography in his time. Milton could not admit a paradise without admitting its opposite. In his book Lives of the Saints, I have read of saints who languished in the contemplation of various body tortures for the sake of their sin or for the love of their Lord. Reward and punishment get all mixed up, so that the zealot who professes to be a faithful servant of God still expects to be punished, to die on the rack. And God benevolently smiles in approval, or chooses to silently ignore this passing of his pawn. The God of the Jews would have at least manifested anger at losing a pawn. In those days, one man holding up his arms could turn the tide of a battle, but later 1,000 Christians dying in the arena while chanting the allegiance of God had no power over a handful of lions. It is no wonder that a sobering period was to ensue, and a trend toward materialism, or, as it was called at the time, an age of reason. The Inquisition was the final monstrous act of masochism that sent Europe and Christendom reeling into the age of reason. Doctrine was replaced by experimentation. Science looked into everything from magic to alchemy. It was called metaphysics, but it was actually a sincere attempt to find a tangible religion. Witches, astral influences, fairies, magi, werewolves, elementals, incubi, succubi, homunculi, reincarnation, and translation were all mixed up together. This was a commendable investigation, being objective analysis of phenomena with an aim at finding the proper relation between these phenomena and man. The search for God. We approach this subject with the heavy awareness of our limitations, whether our approach to God be direct as a moth flying into the sun, or indirect and cautious as a tiny bookworm trying to digest every book in the library. In every library. And the task is burdensome enough without harnessing ourselves with a load of guilt or responsibility every step of the way and with every mistake in every step. The old concepts of sin must go. They represented acts which were responses to compulsions whose origins are primeval. We are, for the most part, mobile robots with built-in reflexes. As the Bhagavad Gita explains. But we are robots that hope to take over our own computers. And somewhere along the line, someone legislated that if we are to take over the computers, we must first admit personal liability for any decisions of the computer. This would be assumed to be a sensible idea only if we could completely control the computer. And completely controlling the individual involves controlling his destiny, which would mean controlling the environment with all of its known and unknown laws of operation. We arrive now at the conjecture that we are not supposed to presume to know that which is planned by God for us. This may be true, and it is just as possible that it is not true. There is always the possibility that all knowledge is available and proportional to our ability to remove limitations. If we are not supposed to know that which God is doing with us, then we are placed in a position of insignificance in which any attitude of ours toward God would not flatter that God one iota. And our existence would be as meaningless and mortal as an expendable, erodible cog in a machine of 2 billion cogs. There is also the possibility that there is truly a personable God who is the creator and master of all, but who pays little or no attention to us because he has more important creatures with which to amuse himself. We like to think that God created us as perfect creatures for reasons of perfect joy. We appraise him with human standards of pleasure and flatter ourselves into the picture by claiming that we are giving a command performance for his pleasure. We take too big a step when we conjure up a God that surmounts all time and space and then pretend to know him on a first-name basis. The one-God theory, as meaning something synonymous with a first cause, can be understood as a concept. But there is evidence that the one-God theory is not the result of personal knowledge or research, but rather the result of clever theology or theological diplomacy, whereby all the conflicting religions were ingested and included rather than opposed as adversaries. Even the ancients realized that the system of thinking which explained the most would last the longest. The layman of ancient times, while not as educated as today's layman, still saw all kinds of advantages from incorporating the tax-hungry priestcraft all under one roof. Theosophy has many good points. It neglects to define God as a personal being, both inaccessible to and yet threatening to man. It emphasizes rather the pyramid of spiritual endeavor and the need to contact spiritual teachers on higher strata of the pyramid. The word pyramid is intentionally capitalized here because it represents one of the major concepts of this book. The only hope of man lies in the existence of a source of knowledge or direction that is human. And while some may say that all lies within ourselves, we find that even the cloistered monks find a need for cooperation with other humans to secure their meditation. There are, besides teachers of relative wisdom, teachers of direction, which are most rare. Some mystics depend upon spirits or angels, presuming that these spirits are closer to God or in possession of knowledge of other dimensions. We have the case of Joan of Arc, If we are to look at the history of her life, we must admit that she was in contact from childhood with elves or fairies, and later in life with an angel whom she identified as Saint Michael. Now, Saint Michael was not a canonized saint, and in fact was older than both Catholicism and Christianity. He is supposed to be the spirit that spoke to Moses in the burning bush. The voices that instructed Joan were knowledgeable. They correctly informed her to identify the Dauphin Charles and betrayed to her a prayer that Charles admitted was known only to God and himself. With these angels' help, she was able to locate the lost sword of Charles Martel, which she used to lead the French. The victories which she predicted came to pass. Yet the story has puzzling facets. St. Michael the Archangel was not her only prompter. St. Catherine and St. Margaret, two ex-humans, also prodded her to take over military leadership. The English were Christian as well as the French. What was going on in heaven? What interest could angels and saints have in the politics of France, especially when the mills of God take care of the destinies of men? We are led to believe that God was in need of Joan of Arc. Yet, if this is true, why did God abandon Joan to defeat, to a trial conducted by men, and finally to a fiery death? Like the daemon of Socrates, when the crisis of death drew near, Saint Michael did not lift a spear. We may say that Joan knew all of this would happen. Yet the whole affair does nothing to promote faith in God among men. And more so, it is likely to make us think twice before listening to discarnate beings, regardless of their ultra-mundane abilities. If the philosophers and saints were left holding an empty sack, what do we have to hope for? As has often been noted, Christ apparently was abandoned in his final hours, all of which brings us back to the problem of understanding all the sources of revelation, whether they be voices, invisible entities who make themselves known by indirect means, or entities which are visible. The Bible itself warns of familiar spirits, but nowhere do we find a formula for distinguishing between beneficial, honest entities and those which make use of us and then drop us. In regard to Joan of Arc, I have come to the conclusion that her fate was somehow related to her virginity. It is said that she was rearrested for putting on a pair of pants. Previously, she had been arrested and had admitted to certain charges brought against her by the ecclesiastical inquisition. The male attire was taken as proof of her relapse. In looking for common denominators, there is evidence that innocence plays a part in the commerce between humans and entities. The demons invoked by Cellini and the priest demanded that a virgin boy be brought to the next invocation. We find poltergeist visitations to be more phenomenal when there are children of adolescent or pre-adolescent years involved, all of which would mean that virginity was the power that Joan possessed, and for reasons unknown to us, it attracted either spirits of stature or spirits that were able to impersonate biblical characters and saints. And possibly, as long as Joan was a virgin, Prince Charles was supposed to have had her examined, she had the service of those spirits. We come to one of the great secrets of occult work. As Eliphas Levi advises, the thaumaturgist observes celibacy, at least for certain periods of time prior to most rituals or invocations. The dangers of listening to voices are evident in many publicized cases where people have even murdered their children at the command of invisible entities which identified themselves as God. Such was the case of Abraham and Isaac. But an angel or a voice arrived in time to prevent Abraham from killing Isaac. I can see the probability of such a sacrifice enacted in modern times by another Abraham, a trusting fanatical fundamentalist, if the latter believed that God actually commanded Abraham, since the Bible is accepted as the true message of God. It follows that if Abraham did not dare to disobey, then neither should anyone else similarly inspired. Man has been able to discern, yet he is not yet fully able to discern. Whereas in previous times the populace was quick to accept any phenomena on quaking knees, we now take a calmer approach and look for a more natural explanation. While not being able to categorize and explain all phenomena, we have become alert to the ability of the mind to impose a fraud upon itself by virtue of its finite nature, and we realize that the mind responds to severe problems with unconscious rationalization and weary surrender to the nearest explanation. We have approached the problem of knowing God objectively, and for many reasons it is impossible. In the first place, we cannot define God until we create a definition, a definitive philosophy for God. As a result of the many God definitions, it is evident that the word God is but a very certain term, uncertain term. Equally portentous is the word gizmodic. A scientist might spend decades sifting through the sands of the sea with a microscope with the pretense that he was looking for a gizmodic. And in this charade, he might actually find a ketone enzyme containing the secret of life. This is a fairy tale just concocted, but we should not be surprised if such a case actually occurred to find that the scientist was quickly ordained as a prophet by virtue of his new power, and to find that gizmodic, which previously meant nothing, which would now be capitalized. It is better to avoid the use of the word God or definitions that not have been yet ascertained, except in the magical processes of prayer. In our objective or relative search, we can only retreat from ignorance and error. We may build imposing conceptual structures whose foundations are hypotheses, but we should never make the mistake for a moment of forgetting that the original hypotheses are still there, still qualifying the whole structure. So that for any research value, we find the voices of unseen entities and the directives of apparitions are unreliable, and there are no final authority for the seeker. Nor are they of any use in the search for God. It stands to reason that if God or any other being is of bidimensional power desired to communicate with us through an angel, then that God would use its ultimate power to clarify that medium of communication by denying any spirit the means to communicate with man in a fraudulent manner. If we are able to presume the existence of an omnipotent God, we must assume that he is not concerned with our confusion.